Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 523rd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta. And today, we have joining us another peer member, Jennifer Young. Jennifer, introduce yourself, please.
Hi. Thanks. It's great to be on it. I've listened to so many of these. It's fun to be part of this team and to be on the podcast. I'm a family doctor in Collingwood, Ontario. I am also working as an associate clinical professor at McMaster, and I'm a part of the KET team. I'm a part-time employee of the College of Family Physicians of Canada, helping out with creation of educational products, which is part of that KET team. Mike's my boss, so I have to do a good job on this.
Yeah, this is the linchpin for you, Jennifer. Yeah. This doesn't succeed.
And if all of a sudden the podcast becomes very awkward, we know why.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Better be looking for a job at Tim Hortons.
Yeah. So Mike, we've recently done a little bit of stuff on urinary tract infections, and you know, we talked about prevention and stuff. And so, what was really cool was you and Jennifer and Betsy did a look at how do we diagnose symptomatic uncomplicated urinary tract infections. And so, Jennifer, why don't you lead us through that? Because I think that was the question you guys had, was how do you? There's so many things we can use around diagnosis, but what should we use? I think that was kind of the clinical question, right?
Yeah.
And it proved to be a really challenging tool for practice, wading through the evidence and figuring out what it meant. I think what I'm going to start with is just how common this is. And all of us know, probably on a daily basis as family doctors, we diagnose uncomplicated urinary tract infections. Yeah, and that I did want to clarify, we were looking at cystitis, bladder infection, uncomplicated urine infections, not ones that are with fever or persistent or non-responding or catheterized. Just this is your garden variety, somebody with symptoms that are suggestive of a bladder infection.
And we'll just clarify even more that it's not asymptomatic bacteria. They're two totally different creatures. It's not people who have a catheter. It's none of this. It's the classic, often thought of as a younger woman who's coming in with symptoms of a bladder infection. That's really who this is focused on.
Right. Yeah. And so amongst that group of people, so that population, of the people calling in to say, I think I've got a urine infection, between 50 to 80% of women who call in actually do have a urine infection that is confirmed on a urine culture. So it is super common, and women usually know when they have it. So that prevalence, and I just, because we're going to be talking a little bit about likelihood ratios and sensitivity specificity, yeah, but mostly likelihood ratios, I just wanted to say prevalence is your pre-test probability.
No, exactly. And that's sort of your baseline. And then when we're sort of doing this diagnostic stuff, we go, do we need to do a test? Are we happy with if it was 50 or 60%, would we treat? And if we wouldn't treat and we'd want to be more sure of an infection, we could do a test that would increase our chance that it was a bladder infection. Or if we said, well, if we only thought it was maybe 10% chance of a urinary tract infection, that then we wouldn't treat, then we'd want to do a test that would reduce that number. And so so I guess as I read through this, my first thing to you guys would be, if you were... And I think this is this is actually the key number, is if someone comes in saying, I have a urinary tract infection, it's between 50 to 80%. In my mind, and you guys have more experience with this, that's enough to go, I guess we probably should treat.
So wait a second, James, you are ruining the both the punchline of this and
yeah.
the
bottom line.
Oh no, but no, we'll also, punch it again. I promise.
No, but also we've got another Tools for Practice coming out about whether you should just treat a urinary tract infection, and it talks about the evidence around that. So we don't want to lead too far down there because there's good evidence around what to do. But you're totally right that it absolutely stems from this underlying number. And for context for some other people, what kind of numbers do we have with strep throat, for example, and you're using a Mackysic score or what have you, a CentOR score to sort it out. And even when the numbers are high, the prevalence, the post-test probability, once you've gone through your questionnaire for either one of those is, I think it gets up to something in the 40s.
No, you're exactly right. Yeah. Because when you come in, if a person comes in with a sore throat, the chance that it's strep throat is in the 10% maybe.
Right. And if you do all of the kind of questions around and examine around tender lymph nodes and beefy red exudate tonsils and all of that stuff, you can get to maybe 40. And many people have considered that's enough to go ahead and treat. Although now we have rapid tests, we won't get into that. But if we've set the thresholds often historically at 30, 40%, the people walking through the door here, the particularly uncomplicated cystitis females walking through the door are already at enough to initiate antibiotics. And every question we ask after that, unless it dramatically shifts that, we'll be challenged to justify much because it could be more confusing than helpful, which is exactly the route Jennifer's going to take us down and explain.
Exactly.
I don't know if you want to add anything to that, like the idea that is that number enough to just jump off of?
Yeah, and I would say what's the evidence for that being the right number? It is contextual. So if the treatment is very dangerous, then we would maybe change that threshold for treatment. But nonetheless, that I would say we don't have evidence to say that 50% number is the right number, but it is, it's generally that is felt to be a number that many of us in practice will use as a threshold for treatment. But yes, you've gotten to the bottom line, guys, already, and have stolen my thunder.
We'll let you have a lot of thunder at the end.
Okay, well, so I'm going to start with all of this research, the evidence that has led us to this conclusion, that in fact the most important number is this pretest probability, which is the prevalence that's already above the 50% level. So I'm going to start with symptoms. Now, I know that we've just talked about those symptoms. That's what women call about, are their symptoms. Are the additional symptoms that a clinician will ask any more helpful? Like, is there one that's the money? And in this one, there were four systematic reviews that we looked at, and the largest one in primary care looked at about 3,700 women. And in that, the additional likelihood ratio, the additional help that symptom or a specific symptom gave was never more than, so for frequency, for example, that in addition to, added on to what the woman's already come about, if you add that on as a clinician-elicited symptom, it's a likelihood ratio of 1.09 and a negative likelihood ratio of 0.58. Now, James, I think this is a good time to jump in around the likelihood ratios. I know that we talked about it in the Tool for Practice. We put it down at the end in terms of context.
Yeah.
But I think it will help the listeners to understand, okay, so what does that likelihood ratio mean? And you said you had some really cool numbers and context around that. Did you want me to give my?
Yeah, what don't you give? Yeah, what do you, well, because I've been, blamed of taking away all the thunder.
Yes.
So please feel free to go and
give me a little bit of thunder and lightning.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Enlightening is what I'm getting. Okay. So a likelihood ratio is so we always talk about sensitivity and specificity. And I think a lot of us have a pretty good concept of what that means. If a test is sensitive, it's going to pick it up. If it's But the specificity part is what is integrated into that sensitivity, the likelihood ratio. So you've got a test that's super sensitive. So you got the disease, it's going to pick it up. But if that test happens to be overly sensitive and also gives you lots of false positives, that's the specificity part of things. So then a positive test doesn't mean very much. And that's what the likelihood ratio does, is to combine both sensitivity and specificity and give us a number that is in the range of, so for a positive likelihood ratio, those ratios are a 1 or above. And a negative likelihood ratio means that it's you don't have the disease. It is it is less than 1. So this would be where, so that was kind of my, how I got to understand why a likelihood ratio is actually a better, more informative number than sensitivity or specificity.
Yeah, no, totally agree. And I think it just makes it, and it's also a single number.
Yeah.
You know, and it also allows us to use varying prevalences as well. You know,
where you can apply the number.
Yeah.
You can apply the number, which is different.
Yeah, so it's mm-hmm. great to know the sensitivity and specificity, and knowing that you can determine the likelihood ratio. And I think, you know, our lives are already complicated enough. We don't need to make it really complicated by making, you know, having to do multiple calculations. But if you know the likelihood ratio, and like you said, the likelihood ratio, the positive likelihood ratio, if you say that they have frequency of 1.1, I that barely changes anything. It doesn't change your baseline much at all, and I think you'd agree with that, Mike?
No, so these numbers are telling us that at least in this study, there's not much happening there. And those questions, as a clinician and an evidence nerd, when I would read these numbers before, I would go, okay, I don't even know if I'm going to ask that anymore, because it's so unhelpful. And I think it's partly because of how prevalent the condition is, that gives me enough information already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we when you have sort of guidelines around what's helpful. So likelihood ratio, a positive likelihood ratio of more than 10 is felt to be very helpful. 5 to 10 is good. 2 to 5 is moderate, and less than 2 is not helpful. So then let's go back to those numbers that I was talking about. So the frequency, likelihood ratio, positive likelihood ratio, 1.09, dysuria and urgency around 1.17. And the highest, so basically they're just not helpful in addition to the symptom complex that a person would already have come in with. So that's kind of where your urinary tract symptoms are. I would say one little bit that we didn't put in the tool for practice was just that vaginal discharge and is something. If someone says they have a vaginal discharge, that will reduce slightly the likelihood that they have a urinary tract infection. So it steers you a little bit away from it, but not so much so that if they have all those gold stamp, those classic symptoms of frequency, dysuria, and hematuria, urgency, then the diagnosis of UTI is likely enough for us to go ahead and treat.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think, you know, the one number that you have there, the highest positive likelihood ratio that you have for sort of any symptoms is 2. And if you, here's a rough tip at this, when it comes to that sort of stuff, if you have a likelihood ratio of 2 and your baseline is around 50, that might take you up to about 70. So it does increase the chance that it's a urinary tract infection. But if you wouldn't change whether you treat it 50 or 70, that test doesn't help you. That's sort of the thought process. And the same with the negative likelihood ratios. If you, with a negative likelihood ratio of about 0.5, even that doesn't get rid of it all that much. It might take it from 50 down to maybe about 30. So and we'll put all this in some of the handout material, because we've been asked to write an article in the BMJ about how to think about all of these numbers, and we created some simple tools and suggestions for how to do that. But exactly as Jennifer's talking about, if you know the likelihood ratio and you know the ballpark impact it has on your prevalence, it really, really helps you decide whether or not you want to test. And I think you guys would suggest, especially with the prevalence at 50 to 60%, any sort of symptom thing doesn't change things enough that it might change what you would do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's because of what Jennifer said earlier, that the treatment is relatively innocuous.
Yeah.
There's talk about, you know, what does antibiotics do to the larger system and stuff, but for the individual patient, you know, 1 to 3 days of antibiotics is quite safe in almost all cases. And we'll talk about, like, should you be treating patients anyway for this in another podcast, but in this one, like, you know, if you're looking at making the diagnosis is made when the patient books the appointment.
Yeah. And I'm assuming, especially if they've already had some ones before.
Yeah. Well, that's some of it, but it's not all of it.
Yeah.
So that's what's interesting to me. Yeah. So Jennifer, why don't you take us through like the year in dip? Cause that's, it's almost a standard of what we do in medicine. And, you know, we kind of put a lot of weight on that.
Right. And we could save a whole lot of money by not doing it. And so the urine dip was similarly. So leukocytes, that's a reflection of white blood cell counts. Likelihood ratio positive of one, a whopping 1.4. And that's not really going to change whether somebody's got leukocytes in their urine or not, then isn't going to change whether I treat it. The negative likelihood ratio was 0.44. So the absence of it is also not something that will tell me not to treat. So leukocytes are right up there with lack of usefulness. And nitrites are a tiny bit different in that if they're not there, so that negative likelihood ratio is 0.5. So it's not that helpful. But the positive likelihood ratio, so if they do have a nitrite positive, then it's the likelihood ratio is 6.5. So it's in that moderately helpful range. Interestingly, I didn't realize this, but nitrites only pick up gram-negative bacteria. And as we know, E. coli is the most common cause of urinary tract infections. But Staph saprophyticus is a gram-positive, and it would not be picked up on a nitrite.
And I think, and I was going to say, and so with a likelihood ratio of around, I know it's at 6, but let's say around 5, that will take the 50% that you're already working with, and it'll take you up to about 80%. But that doesn't help you, because you've already decided that you probably would have treated it 50. Do you see? Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the thought process. So it does, you know, a likelihood ratio of 5 is not completely useless, but it is in the context of it wouldn't have changed what you would have done anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And then the other part of a dip is the positive blood, blood that's more than 1+, and the positive likelihood ratio there is 2.1, and the negative is 0.03. So at the end of the day, it's similar to the others. The only one then that really could have was in that moderate range would be nitrates.
And so when you guys went through all this, What were some of the limitations that you found with the evidence?
Well, I was amazed at how old the studies were. Most of them were more than 30 years old.
I think
old,
it's because people have had urinary tract infections, I think, since 1930.
But not much has changed, James. We're doing great research on vitamin D, and we don't have time to research something as rare as urinary tract infections.
Mike, you've got to get over vitamin D.
It's not vitamin D that I'm getting over. It's people's interest in it, but it's all of that kind of thing. Multivitamins, you name it. We're spending massive trials when UTIs, we haven't had a decent study in years. So
it's really amazing. And so the other thing is that the definition of a positive urine culture is also interesting. It can range from 10 to the 2 to 10 to the 8 colony forming units in some of these studies. And obviously, if you only will say somebody's got a urinary tract infection if they have 10 to the 8 bacteria, it's going to be harder to give that diagnosis of a urinary tract infection. They've just, you know, you've set the standard, set the bar pretty high. But if you make it 10 to the 10 to the 2, you'll pick up more of those on the urine culture.
This is a really important piece, actually, that we don't talk about enough, but about cutoffs, that as you increase the criteria, make it harder and harder to make the diagnosis, your sensitivity goes down and your specificity goes up. So you're always, whenever you're choosing cut points, you're making that compromise, which we often don't think about, but as a gold standard, it makes it even more complicated. But I think, Jen, one of the pieces that we don't, that we didn't talk about yet is the fact that the gold standard itself is maybe not a great gold standard.
I know, that was an amazing study that we came across, which was one that looked at using both urinary culture and doing a PCR test on the same urines. And they found that 80% of these women who had symptoms had a positive culture. So kind of like what we've just been talking about, but 96% ended up having were positive for PCRs. So there you go. You have this gold standard urine culture and it isn't even all that golden.
Yeah. So they were potentially missing at least. So these were women presenting with symptoms. We said that 4 out of 5 of them had a urinary tract infection positive on culture. But if you use a different standard, it would have been much closer to 5 out of 5 of them. So we were missing 20% or almost 20%.
Yeah. When I read this, I was exactly the same way. So what it tells you is that if the prevalence that we were talking about right at the beginning, which apparently I ruined the entire podcast, but it was
no, 50, you didn't ruin it. James.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
No, it's not the first time.
It's not. I try to ruin as many as I can.
Yeah.
And so if the prevalence that we're talking about was 50 to 60%, yet we're using the positive culture to determine that prevalence, it's probably even higher than that.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think. It's hard to wrap my mind around the idea that it could be less. It's only going to be higher. And if you look, there was another study where they didn't treat some women who were negative on their first culture. And if they just followed them, a third of them got positive by their standard inevitably. So it's a really, in other words, we're probably missing those people too. So if you look at those two studies together, it suggests very strongly that the 60% baseline risk of having a the prevalence is likely understated and perhaps considerably.
Yeah, and that even fundamentally makes it even less likely that a test will help you.
Yeah, because if your baseline rate is 80, why do you need to do anything?
So sorry, Mike, the only caveat would be if we had a test that could take it from 80 down to 10.
Yes. That's a different matter.
But we don't have that test.
Well, we don't. The likelihood ratios that are negative, so what would help rule out, are all in the kind of 0.5 range,
which is
pretty much useless. So it's really, it's similar to the inverse, is like a 2 positive likelihood ratio. So it's really not helpful. And this is a good kind of reflection in the clinical scenarios, because it's a bit different. If you're talking about most of the treatments or most of the conditions where we consider prescribing antibiotics, like pneumonia, people don't come in, you know, they don't book your appointments at and have a baseline risk of 60% chance of pneumonia saying, I have a cough, I think I have pneumonia. As clinicians, we know full well that most of the patients don't have pneumonia who are concerned about it. In this case, it's the opposite of that. Women who are booking appointments, they almost certainly have a UTI.
Mm-hmm. And just, you know, while we're on that topic of antibiotic stewardship, I am really on that bandwagon, and I really hate prescribing antibiotics when I don't, when they're not necessary. And so that pretest probability with the sore throat, with the cough, with the runny nose, with the tender sinuses, that is a low pretest probability for a bacterial infection. And so treating with antibiotics, that's where our antibiotic resistance and overuse is coming, is in that group of conditions, where the respiratory conditions, it's the overuse of antibiotics in symptomatic, and I'm going to go, because we're going to talk, in symptomatic UTIs is not the issue.
No, and I think you're exactly right. But, you know, and what's really fascinating, though, it is to sort of unpack all of this, you have to have an appreciation for prevalence and the usefulness of the tests and all of that sort of stuff. And hopefully with this really, really good example that you guys have put together, it really helps. Hopefully it helps you guys who are listening think about that. Because, yeah. Jennifer, you're exactly right. I think that the difference between a urinary tract infection and a person who has a sore throat is very, very different, because mm-hmm. almost exclusively because of the prevalence of it. And mm-hmm. And if you don't know the prevalence of a condition and you don't know something about the likelihood ratios of the test, you will likely end up doing many more tests and getting confused about the results, even, because or making decisions that are not even based on what the actual test is telling you. And so we're going to probably spend a lot more time doing that. We'll actually do a podcast all about this when we get this paper published. But this is a really, really good example of that context. So why don't, is there anything else you want to add to that? If not, I'm going to give you the bottom line.
I have good takes. You already gave it at the beginning, but we will repeat it, and I'm happy to do so. But I just wanted to add again, this is a stay tuned kind of statement. Asymptomatic bacteria is a different thing. We are overusing antibiotics a ton in people with asymptomatic bacteria, especially the elderly. Now, that's stealing some thunder from hopefully a subsequent podcast, but I just didn't want to leave this one without making that plea to be very careful about not treating asymptomatic bacteria. But we will give you more details and more evidence to come on that particular issue.
For sure.
Mike, did you want to say anything else on that before I...
So we've got a series coming out on all of this, and I think, we'll hit these in stages. The next one is on does a UTI need treatment, where it looked at not treating them and then giving NSAIDs instead. So not treating them at all, then giving NSAIDs as an alternative, and then what happens with the different approaches to treating them. In other words, there is a good trial where they just treated people on spec. So we're leaving you hanging for that. But just, the context and what Jennifer was saying about respiratory. So just to put otitis media would be a great example as something where we've heard we have to worry about stewardship. When a child is booked for an appointment, a young child who's booked for an appointment by their mom, they have a baseline prevalence and they're booked for sore ear, that kind of thing. Their baseline prevalence for kind of a 2-year-old booked for that appointment is around 17%. Mm-hmm. And the likelihood ratios there, why it is so important, is even the worst one is things like pulling on the ear, and that's at 3.3. It's virtually better than anything we saw for UTIs. An actual inspecting, looking at the ear, the bulging tympanic membrane, bulging red tympanic membrane, has a likelihood ratio of 51.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's... Mm-hmm. It's such a lot. Yeah, the number I remember is between 30 and 50, and that pretty much does it.
Yeah. So exactly. So it's a different case here. You wouldn't treat on spec a kid who's booking for an appointment, but you would absolutely go pretty quickly to looking in that kid's ear, because that's where the money is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's the point of these discussions around diagnosis to me is to help us as clinicians to know where to put our efforts when we're faced with such you know, tight timelines and so many patients, so many conditions, we want to try and think, how do we maximize the use of our time while still providing the absolute best care possible?
Yeah, for sure.
And I think it's also useful to, as a clinician, to a priori, if you will, think about what is my treatment threshold? Because I don't know if we intuitively do that all the time to you know, where would I be uncomfortable? Now, I'll give you another. So I think your idea, your otitis media one was a great one, Mike. If, you know, it's the sort of pretest probability is somewhere between 10 and 20%. And if you have a cloudy or bulging eardrum, it basically now it's 80 to 90%. That's what a likelihood ratio of 30 or 50 will do for you. Now, if you had a pretest probability of meningitis of 20%, you might be treating that. In fact, I think you would be treating that.
For sure.
So the only test that you need is a test that would take that 20% down to a very low number.
Yes, very.
It reminds me of helping people understand a review of potential C-spine injuries. And what does it take? Like, what's your pretest probability number where you're like, okay, we don't need to do any more. We can send this person home. Like those numbers are really low. To be comfortable saying, I don't think you have a C-spine injury, because we're quite intolerant of those risks. And obviously, just like the meningitis and all the other things that are very serious like that, we're not talking about that here. And we're not talking about serious consequences of an intervention. If the intervention we were going to do was abdominal surgery, we want to be pretty sure that what we're doing. And I remember a surgeon told me, your goal is to get down to only 20% wrong when you operate for an appendix. Or not 20%, 10% wrong. So your goal is to get to less than that. Out of 10 bellies you open, only one had a normal looking appendix, because of how serious it is and how serious it is to miss. But it just reminds us that when the problem is serious, when the interventions are serious, all of this changes. And it's exactly what Jennifer said at the start. It's contextual.
Yeah, no, exactly. And Mike, the appendix one you brought up, and I don't think we've done a podcast on this, but I can't remember if we have or not, about that. You know, there's some reasonable evidence that we can just treat with antibiotics.
Well, we could talk about that. Probably will be a tools of practice inevitably, but I remember reading early evidence on that early in my career, and being at sea in the Navy and having to make those choices do we turn the ship around, or do we get one day of like throwing antibiotics at someone and see how they do, IV antibiotics? And
we went the
antibiotic route and it went just fine.
I agree with you. And so that's why, and we don't expect everyone to memorize the exact number. All of these things. We think if you have a ballpark idea, is your prevalence 5%, 10%, 20%, 40%, 50%, where around is that? And then the likelihood ratios, and you guys talked about some of the limitations of these. So when we say the likelihood ratio is 1.09,
Don't remember that.
Just remember it's very close to one.
Well, remember the most important thing is none of the questions you're going to ask are going to be as helpful as just knowing the prevalence, which is very high. And it's probably
in this case. So, no, that was great, guys. It's amazing how, you know, there's such a simple thing of urinary tract infections or uncomplicated urinary tract infections. It brings up so many useful pieces of information and contextualization if you look at the evidence.
Yeah.
It's really cool. So you guys did a great job of that. Anything else you want to add, Jennifer?
No. I really enjoyed doing this, learned lots, and helps me for sure as a clinician look at the stuff that I use in my day-to-day to help me beyond that history. And well, I know there's no physical, we didn't talk about the physical here because there isn't really one, but just that the added value of tests after the history is in this case very limited, and often is very limited.
Yeah, no, for sure. And there's a cost associated, and then you may miss understand what the results really mean and so on. So this is great. Anything you need to, do you want to talk about anything, Mike?
Well, she just mentioned CFPC Learn. Yep. It's a program created by the National College. It's an educational online learning, lots of options of ways to learn by videos, reviewing tools to practice. And you can also get credits for this very podcast. So check it out, because if you register, then you can get credits for listening to the podcast, which I think is awesome. And we should also mention the PIPE conference, which is coming up on Friday, the 21st of October, and also the Saturday, the 22nd. We encourage you to take a look. You can listen and attend virtually, or you can join us in Edmonton. We'd love to see you there as well. All three of us will be on that conference, and don't hesitate to come up and tell us where we went wrong.
Well, do hesitate if it's me. If it's Mike, just go ahead.
And you can also tell me where James went wrong. That's
yeah, fine. Yeah. And then Mike passes it on usually halfway through any podcast.
Right.
But no, this is great stuff, guys. So if there's nothing else, I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
Talk to you later. Thank you.